Listen and follow the Left Wing Rugby Podcast with me, Will Slattery, and Luke Fitzgerald.
As far as I can see, I always want to get in the Irish team. And that should be every young player's dream and ambition in this country. And if you're playing in a place where you're not going to get the opportunities in the big games, that they're the ones that get you picked. They are the ones, the Champions Cup games are the ones that get you picked. You need to be playing in a team and starting in a team for those games. It's as simple as that if you want to play in the Irish team.
Every week on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. On the latest episode of Real Health with me, Carl Henry, I'm delighted to be joined by trichologist Claire Fulham, chatting all things hair loss.
I remember then going, I'm losing a bit more hair. Like, I could see hair everywhere. It was all over my desk and work everywhere. And so I went to my GP. She found five big patches on my scalp, one the size of my fist. So I was like, right, what am I going to do about this? Give me a plan. She just looked me dead in the eye and said, there's nothing you can do. I went on list for dermatologists. She had a cancellation and she very quickly said, yes, you have alopecia areata.
As ever, available on all podcast platforms.
On this week's Big Tech Show, when you travel, how do you avoid getting completely ripped off on roaming charges outside of Europe? And what are some of the travel hacks you should know about that aren't included in the tech you buy? We give you all the tips you need to know.
On top of my list, Adrian, is my noise-cancelling headphones. When I put them on, I love that it just goes boom, and you're in this kind of sonic bubble and you can't hear the baby and you can't hear that weird frequency of the aircon on the airplane.
The Big Tech Show. Available on all podcast platforms.
A balmy day in a coastal city in Brazil in August 2013. An unassuming man in an orange t-shirt and jeans is quietly escorted by police officers to an unmarked squad car. The man in question was Mayo native Michael Lynn, who'd been on the run since 2008. As a child, he'd sung for Pope John Paul II and gone on to become a lawyer and then a very wealthy Celtic Tiger property developer.
He basically spoke about the time and how banks were competing with each other to throw money at him. He said that in one weekend he raised 10 million euros on the strength of a letter. The feeling was one of euphoria. It was better than sex. Property development was the ultimate high.
He lived the champagne lifestyle with all the social trappings that came along with it.
You know, 25,000 sterling on a private box at Wembley Stadium, also feathering his own pension nest, putting in over 300,000 euros into a fund for his retirement.
But all of that changed with the financial crash when people found out what Michael Lynn was really doing with other people's money.
The Law Society had moved in, they shut down his practice. Lynn was actually about to be questioned about his dealings in the High Court when all of a sudden he vanished and he was gone.
I'm Ellen Coyne, and today on the Indo Daily, I'm joined by Rory Tevlin, Deputy News Editor, and Shane Phelan, Legal Affairs Editor, both with the Irish Independent, to look at the extraordinary story of the Irish lawyer and property tycoon Michael Lynn, the man who played cat and mouse games with Gardaí across continents. What led to the downfall of one of Ireland's brightest businessmen? And is this really the end of the investigation? Shane, he's already been found guilty.
Yes, and he's been sentenced today to 5.5 years in prison. Judge Martin Nolan said Lynn's behaviour had brought his profession into disrepute, that he'd caused severe stress for people working for him, and that he had acted in total disregard to his obligations as a solicitor to be honest and straightforward. And the judge also pointed out that of the 18 million that was stolen by Michael Lynn, 13 million hasn't been recovered.
So Rory, I want you to kind of take us back and help us understand the man himself, Michael Lynn, who became the poster boy for Celtic Tiger Ireland. Who exactly is he and how did he make his name?
Yes, Michael Lynn became kind of synonymous with the darker side and the excesses of the Celtic Tiger era, but he qualified as a solicitor back in 1994 and worked with a number of different law firms and budget travel, but went out on his own in 1997 and set up his own practice, which interestingly originally was run out of a house in Clonsilla where Michael Lynn was living. But as time went on, you know, as he said himself, to people back in Mayo, where he's from originally. Business was good to him. And he built up the law practice into something a bit larger with 15 employees, where he was based out of Blanchardstown in an office there, and continued to build the law practice while getting into property development. And it's the property side of things where he really kind of ran into trouble.
And tell us more about when he was growing up in Mayo. He seemed to have a pretty good family background, pretty happy family life when he was growing up.
Yeah, people in Mayo where he's from would speak of a really well-respected family. The Lynns were well-known, a farming family. As a child, he grew up in a farmhouse that overlooked Loch Gonn, very picturesque part of the world. He was the youngest of five, and people who knew him growing up will speak of a child that was very confident, always did well in school. But being the baby of the family, he had three older sisters and a brother, but he was the apple of his mother's eye. As a young man as well, this is kind of one of the lesser parts of the Michael Lynn story, but he was a very good singer, and he actually sang for Pope John Paul in Rome when he was a child. As he grew older, I think, in terms of his confidence, people have spoken to somebody who'd be the life and soul of the party, and it'd be very hard to get the microphone off him once he started singing.
And even that kind of outgoing personality, the person who liked being the centre of attention, I suppose that kind of bled into his business practices as well. Like, he was a bit of a charmer and a bit of a big personality.
Yeah, I think like many people of that era, in terms of the success of the Celtic Tiger, there are people who confidence went a long way in terms of their business dealings. And Michael Lynn himself has spoken of the fact that, you know, your name was kind of what got you through the door when you were trying to cut deals and that type of thing. So I think the more he built up his property dealings and his law business, the more the confidence kind of almost oozed out of him, and the bigger the personality got. And certainly people spoke of when he went back to Mayo at around the turn of the millennium, he was certainly not shy in telling people about his success up in Dublin as a businessman and a lawyer.
From the kind of late 90s to early 2000s, talk to us about how business appeared to be going for Michael Lynn and how he was faring.
Well, I think the first property deal he did was in 1998, where he bought a house for £100,000 at the time and managed to flip the house and sell it for £185,000 four months later. So I think the die was cast at that stage, and he was bitten by the bug of property development. So as the years went on then, he slowly started to move more into property and less into dealing with the day-to-day business of running his law firm. And he had set up a business for his property development called Kendar Holdings. So by 2004, he's really moved into the property development big time. Kendar ended up with about 20 staff, and they had projects that were running in Portugal, Hungary, Bulgaria. But it was all based on a kind of a foundation of sand, really. The business model was that they would use deposits from unbuilt holiday homes that people had paid to actually fund the projects. And they reckoned that, you know, at one point he was kind of associated with about 150 different properties and projects, which had a kind of a nominal value of about 50 million. So he was really rolling in big money circles.
Shane, Rory was saying there how the entire venture was built on sand, but the way that Lynn was talking about it, he could be fairly brash and bullish talking about his success, and sometimes could be kind of crass when he was talking about his business practices.
Yeah, I suppose even the word he used to describe people who invested in some of these schemes that kind of fell by the wayside, he called them bucaleros. Which is almost kind of a flip and throwaway term. So you'd wonder how much he cared about these guys that were putting money up, and a lot of people did end up losing their money. But yeah, he was kind of crass. We know at a later point when he's abroad and wanted back home by the guards, he gave an interview to Elio Malocco, who listeners will recognise the name. He was another disgraced ex-solicitor. But he basically spoke about the time and how banks were competing with each other to throw money at him. And he said that in one weekend, he raised 10 million euros on the strength of a letter. The feeling was one of euphoria. It was better than sex. Property development was the ultimate high. Even years after all of this, he's still speaking about it in those sort of terms.
Like, he did seem to go about his business as someone who outwardly seemed to think he was invincible, or he seemed to talk as if this was going to last forever. But he did fly too close to the sun, and inevitably things did fall apart from him. Can you tell us how the Michael Lynn story started to unravel?
Yeah, I suppose a lot of this has to do with sort of personality. He is, like, he really had a brass neck and he had some set of cojones on him as well, because what he did was when he needed money, he would go to a bank and he'd get a mortgage, but then he'd go to another bank, get a mortgage on the same property, and another bank and get a mortgage on the same property again. So he had multiple loans out on the same properties. This is ultimately what landed him in trouble in the courts, led to him, you know, being struck off as a solicitor. But it didn't catch up on him for a while. So, for example, he was able to raise a lot of money on Glen Lyon, this 5.5 million euro mansion out in Holt that he bought as a family home. Now, he never ended up living there, but had planned to. And, you know, there was going to be a private beach and like the trappings were fairly incredible. He had a thirst for money. He wanted to fund an extravagant lifestyle. And it only kind of emerged after he disappeared from Ireland that a liquidator found that he'd used about 3 million euros belonging to Kendar Holdings to fund his personal lifestyle. So the sort of spending you're talking about here includes, you know, 25,000 sterling on a private box at Wembley Stadium, feathering his own pension nest, putting in over 300,000 euros into a fund for his retirement, but effectively money that wasn't his to spend in that manner. And it was this, I suppose, call it brass neck, cojones, cavalier approach. It was all of these things. And all of these things ultimately led to his downfall. Things started to unravel for him in the midpoint of 2007. The Irish Independent, actually, my predecessor as legal affairs editor, Dervil MacDonald, broke a story revealing how an at the time unnamed solicitor was being investigated for mortgage fraud. The Law Society had moved in. They shut down his practice. The High Court had ordered documents relating to him to be sent to the Garda Fraud Squad. Lynn was actually about to be questioned about his dealings in the High Court when all of a sudden he vanished and he was gone.
And then the story gets even wilder and it turns into this kind of international cat and mouse game where he was kind of popping up and there were sightings of him here and there. You were kind of following that at the time, I think. Can you tell us what that was like?
Yeah, he was like the Scarlet Pimpernel. He was all over Europe. I remember being out in Portugal looking for him. We knew the haunts. We knew the restaurants he went to and we knew properties associated with him and so on. But we couldn't find any sight or sound of Michael Lynn. We were always seemed to be a day late. Oh, you just missed him. He was just here. It was kind of like that for the guards as well.
But the guards knew that he was in Portugal and he would kind of make noises that he would kind of outwardly at least sometimes make it seem like he was willing to cooperate and he was willing to talk. And then I think he happened to move to a country that coincidentally didn't have a formal extradition arrangement with Ireland when he moved to Brazil.
Yeah, so the guards had various arrangements with him to be interviewed abroad between 2008 and 2011. I think there were maybe three occasions in which there was an agreement. Yeah, okay, guys, you can come over and talk to me and we'll have an old chat. And it never happened for one reason or another. You know, they were put off. In June 2011, without informing investigators, Michael Lynn headed off to Brazil. And as you pointed out, a country with no formal extradition treaty with Ireland. And when he left for Brazil, it was only shortly before the guards had actually been due to travel to Portugal to speak to him.
But he wasn't acting like a man on the run. Like when he was living in Brazil, I think I read he was living public life. He was using his real name. He didn't seem like someone who was hiding.
Yeah, so he, what we know about his life in Brazil, he was living in a beachside city near Recife, living openly. He was teaching English, granted residency there. The police would later say that he'd led a quiet life and used his real name. Didn't seem to be worried about being arrested. And maybe he was a bit naive. Just because there wasn't a formal extradition treaty didn't mean he couldn't be extradited.
There seems to be a lot going on between Ireland and Brazil that maybe he wasn't aware of at the time.
Yeah, so what actually happened in the end was a kind of an ad hoc agreement was reached to secure his extradition.
He was arrested in Recife in Brazil, where he was working as a teacher in August of last year. And he's been in jail ever since, despite complaints of poor health.
He put up a bit of a fight, went all the way to Brazil's Supreme Court, which ruled that he should be extradited. But he fought like a tiger not to come back. You know, he has said that he's kind of denied that he was trying to block his extradition, but it doesn't really hold any water. That led to him having a prolonged stay in a Brazilian prison.
And what do we know about what that was like?
Well, we have his account of it, which is very, very colourful. He likened it to being in the series Game of Thrones, which we all know is quite violent, and people routinely get stabbed and have their heads chopped off and things like that. So he claimed in one particular incident that a prisoner in the jail was decapitated for being gay. We don't know the veracity of that, but he did say it under oath. He described the prison as a hellhole, that it was run by the inmates, that the authorities kind of had a hands-off approach to kind of just let them all at it and stood on the side.
And all the while, Rory, I'm conscious that when he went over to Brazil, his partner Breed did eventually follow him over and she did kind of stand by his side. She's an interesting character as well.
Yes, the couple first met after a match in Portobello in 2000 and kind of went their separate ways. But then they crossed paths again years later in 2004. And after just a few months of dating, Michael Lim popped a question and they subsequently got married in 2004. Breed was working as an ICU nurse in St. Vincent's Hospital, and around the time when Michael Lim was living in Portugal, she took a career break to look after her sick father. And she has told the court how she would travel back and forth from Ireland to Portugal to meet with her husband. But Breed, when she was 26, had cervical cancer. So this kind of led to some fertility issues. So she has told the court that originally the reason for them to travel to Brazil was to meet a doctor who, you know, to try and solve the fertility issues. And subsequently, she became pregnant. So they travelled back and forth between Portugal and Brazil, meeting with the doctor throughout the pregnancy. And then eventually the couple, as Shane has told us, moved to Brazil and were living in Brazil. But interestingly, as Michael Lynn was spending that time in the hellhole prison in Brazil, there was conjugal visits between Breed and Michael in the prison that were allowed to happen by the authorities. And Michael actually fathered two children behind bars.
So eventually, Michael and his wife and his children come back to Ireland. At this point, how long had he actually spent in the Brazilian prison before the extradition was successful?
Yeah, he'd been there about 4.5 years, so quite a lengthy period of time.
So it's 2018, he's finally returned to Ireland, and then it's not until 2022 when he faces trial. What happened with that trial?
Yeah, so he went on trial, but the jury was discharged. It couldn't reach a verdict. So we had to have the prospect of a second trial. The charges he faced basically related to 21 counts of theft totaling around 27 million euros. So this is money which was borrowed using, you know, multiple mortgages on the same properties. And there were seven financial institutions involved. Now, he denied those counts. All of this was supposed to have taken place in 2006 and 2007, I suppose, shortly before his downfall. Jury found him guilty on 10 counts, so 10 of the 21, and those amounted to him stealing 17.9 million euros from six of the seven institutions. And they were unable to agree on the remaining 11 counts on the indictment. Now, most of those counts related to money that was borrowed from Irish Nationwide Building Society, and it had been an interesting part of, I suppose, of Michael Lynn's defence during the second trial was his claims that the Irish Nationwide boss, Michael Fingleton, had done a deal with him in 2006, and that under this deal, Fingleton was to receive a stake in various property developments in Portugal in return for the loans. It may well be that had put some doubt in the jury's mind in relation to those counts. We don't know. Of course, Michael Fingleton has had some very well-documented health issues and wasn't able to give evidence to corroborate or contradict that evidence.
And how did the prosecution kind of characterise or describe Michael Lynn when they were summing up their case?
Carol Finnegan, the senior counsel who was prosecuting, said he was someone who'd tried to pull the wool over the bank's eyes. He said that he thought Mr. Lynn was a risk taker and that it was clear that he lived for the next big deal and was still gambling. But the gamble had changed. This was in, you know, addressing the jury. You know, the gamble he's making now is that you might accept his version of events. He said it didn't matter if the banks had been shoddy, careless or reckless. Theft is theft.
And even with the verdict and sentencing, Rory, the story doesn't even end there, because we had reports in the Irish Independent last week that Gardaí are kind of on this money haul scramble.
Yeah, I suppose like all good sagas, just when you think it's about to draw to a close, there's another chapter. This is a story our Crown correspondent Ken Foy had the other day. So a number of searches were carried out at locations to essentially searching for money that Gardaí suspect Michael Lynn has stashed away. So detectives carried out searches of 5 properties and a number of bank accounts have been frozen, which are all linked to Michael Lynn. Now, during the course of these searches, a 4-figure sum of cash was seized. But sources have told ourselves that this is kind of the tip of the iceberg, they feel, and that there's a lot more money hidden away that they're still searching for.
And my thanks to Shane Phelan and to Rory Tevlin. I'm Ellen Coyne, and today's episode of the Indo Daily was produced by Garrett Mulhall, researched by Dave Hannerty, recorded by John Smith, with sound design by Gavin Hennessy. Archive clips from News Talk and The Irish Independent. If you enjoy the Indo Daily, don't forget to like, follow, and leave us a review.
Remember, you can stay up to date on the latest news with the Irish Independent WhatsApp channel.